All right, we're ready for chapters 21 and 22 in the book of Deuteronomy, making our way through this second sermon of Moses. There are three or four sermons, I think four, you may think three. We'll get to that a little later in the book. At least through chapter 26, we're all in agreement. This is the second sermon. And a little longer in content as it's recorded. I don't know if it's longer in delivery or not, but here we are in this second sermon as Moses looks within. He looks at a review of the law and obedience to the law, and he talks about testimonies, statutes, and judgments, and we're in this last section of 19 to 26. Obviously, if you've read the lesson for tonight, you see why that fits there in the judgment section. So we're in that second speech that reviews the law. So we have a lot of information, even tonight, that we've seen before in Exodus and Leviticus, but then there is some new information or expansion or explanation or examples given, and we'll get to that as we come to them. Let's review where we have been. Chapter 1 begins the first sermon with, all right, here's the history. Continuing that history, so chapter 2 was, all right, very good. Wilderness wanderings and victory over Sihon. Sihon, yes. Chapter 3, victory over the next king who was Og, and Moses being forbidden to enter, among other things. Chapter 4, a good way to end this sermon, necessity of obedience. We've got to obey. We see that over and over again. So chapter 5 begins with the second sermon, what we're in. This was the beginning of this sermon. 10 Commandments. Chapter 6 backs up and gets a broader view. Place. Yeah, here's the purpose, the meaning, etc. of the law. This is what the law is all about. Chapter 7, this is going to be important in tonight's lesson. Separate people, a distinct people. He drives that point home in our study tonight. Chapter 8, keeping the commandments. Chapter 9, yeah, you don't want to think that you did this on your own. We'll see a little bit of that in our study tonight. Chapter 10. Yeah, come back to obedience again. Mercy and obedience. Chapter 11. Yeah, love and obey the Lord. Very good. Chapter 12. Why does chapter 12 stand out? Yeah, the place that God chooses. And he'll mention that as the place. Doesn't name the name or the city, but the place that God chooses. And we've talked about why. Chapter 13. Idolatry, destruction of those that are involved in idolatry. Chapter 14. All right, mourning and unclean and unclean and unclean. Chapter 15. 7-year release. 16. Review of the 3 annual feasts. Chapter 17. Idolaters and a king. Very good, very good. Chapter 18. And very good. Chapter 18 stands out because prophet like Moses, mentioned time and again, and particularly when we come to the New Testament. Chapter 19, cities of refuge, very good. Landmarks and witnesses. And chapter 20 wound up last week with laws concerning warfare. Very good. All right. Now those are the first 20 chapters. Now we still have 6 more chapters before this sermon is through. And so in this, he's going to be reviewing some miscellaneous laws. So chapter 21, this in answer to question number 1, deals with miscellaneous laws. Kaufman observed at this juncture that it seems like, and I don't think this was being critical of Moses, he has respect for Moses. If you read Kaufman at all, I don't read a lot of his stuff, but catch a little bit of it. But nonetheless, that Moses seems to be somewhat disorganized in his delivery here. And because he's dealing with so many miscellaneous things, and it has no structure, and yet he groups them together. Well, that's a kind way of saying he takes things that don't go together and put them together. And we often do that, and that's what Moses does here. It is a little hard to organize some things that don't necessarily fit together, but they do have a common bond, and the common bond is these are the laws and the statutes and the judgments of God. And that's the common bond they have. The common thought in chapters 21 and 22 of the miscellaneous laws has to do with respect for life and respect for others. Colin Dalich developed that. Some of you may have that kind of a hefty commentary on the Old Testament, Colin Dalich, the Germans. But nonetheless, they developed that thought, and I think could do a good job of that, suggesting that the commonality of these laws have to do with respect for life and respect for others. And there is that commonality of these laws. Another introductory thought we need to add, some of these laws are what we might refer to as contingency laws. Now that's important to understand by the time we get to chapter 24. Chapter 24, 1 to 4, has to do with Moses' regulation on divorce. And that was contingency law. What is contingency law? I don't know. You can ask Jeff back here sometime and he can tell you more about the details. But nonetheless, some of our laws might say something like this, that if you're driving and you run a red light and you have a crash, here's what you do. Did that give you permission to run a red light? No. Did it give you permission to have a crash? No. It's just saying there will be occasions where people violate the law, and here's what you do when they violate the law. That's contingency law. At least in the Old Testament, that's what contingency law involves. So, for example, let's get ahead of ourselves down to verse 15 of chapter 21. He deals with polygamy. 15 to 17, the rights of the firstborn in a polygamous marriage. Does that give any endorsement to polygamy? No. Does it say God says he doesn't care about polygamy? No. It just says there will be people who are in a polygamous marriage, contrary to God's law, and here's what they're going to try to do, and here's the law that governs that. Even in cases of murder, that didn't give you a right to murder. It just says if there is murder, here's what you do. So a lot of this is contingency law, and we'll get to that and flag that as we go along. All right, let's start with the first section here. There's an unsolved murder in verses 1 to 9. And what do you do in a case of an unsolved murder? So let's work through and see the four things that happen in this little section. If there is a body that's found that's slain out in the field, and they don't know who did that, verse 1, what are they to do? All right, that we ain't got that far yet. That's as far as we're going right now. At verse 2, you have the elders and the judges. Now, there are judges that are appointed. There are the elders of the city. They're not the same. And so these elders and the judges are of that nearest city, wherever the slain body is found, they go and measure to the nearest city. And then they go to the elders of that nearest city. Now what happens in verses 3 and 4? The elders of that city are to take a heifer, and they take it down to the valley with flowing water that's never been plowed or sown. In other words, it's rough territory. They take this heifer down to that rough territory near flowing water, and what are they to do with that heifer? Break its neck. Some translations, and you may have one, and you may be checking one of the translations, say, I'm not sure what that means. Some translations suggest that to cut the neck off, in other words, cut the head off, sever, the idea they translated of severing or removing the head, beheading, I think, is some of the ways they translate that. It doesn't actually mean to behead. It means literally to break the neck. The same word is used, by the way, in Exodus 3 and 13 and Exodus 34 and 20 of breaking the neck of a lamb. In Isaiah 66 and 3, the breaking the neck of a dog. And so literally, they were to break the neck. So what was the purpose of that? Well, seemingly, it's symbolic of what should have been done to the murderer that we don't know who that is. And so they take this heifer, and something has to be done. Now, I want to get ahead of myself down to verse 23. It talks about defiling the land. Crime, sin, corruption, you name it, that's contrary to the will of God, corrupts and defiles the land. I don't mean by that it's defiling the soil, but it's defiling the territory wherein this sin is not accounted for or the sin is not dealt with. That's the point. So deal with the sin. So here is a murder. We don't know who did it. No one saw it. No one witnessed it. So we get the elders and the judges involved, and they're measuring, and they find out this is the nearest city. They then are the elders, the elders take off this heifer off down there, and they break its neck. Again, symbolically suggesting that's what should have been done to the murderer had we known who the murderer was. He should have been killed. Not that you'd break his neck, but he ought to be stoned to death. Now at verse 5, we're not told what the priests are to do. Look at verse 5. The priests then are to come near. It doesn't say what they're to do, but it tells their role generally. And I want to give a little conjecture what I think maybe they're doing. The priest shall come near, and these are the ones God has chosen to bless in his name. And by their word, every controversy and every assault or stroke shall be settled. I take it that means that they have the final say, since they are priests, that they're presiding over this procedure and all that's to be done. Otherwise, I'm not sure what they're doing. Anybody got any better guesses than that? That they're presiding over to see that now the elders are the ones that are take this heifer down and they're breaking its neck, but the priests come out. Now, what are they there to do? Apparently to observe and to preside over, and whatever they say has the final word. In other words, if they tell them, you're not at the place where the flowing water is, they need to get to the flowing water. If they tell them you haven't broke its neck, they need to break its neck. They have the final say. They're presiding over. They have some authority, in other words. Then what do the elders do? Verses 6 to 9. They wash their hands and they say something. And Kevin's right, but before we get to what he just said, look at verse 7. Yeah, we didn't do this. We didn't witness this. And so this is a symbolic cleansing of the people, lest the guilt be upon the people. So provide atonement for your people that you have redeemed, and do not lay innocent blood to the charge, and the atonement shall be provided on behalf of the blood. So in other words, the people are no guilt is going to be coming upon the people, no defilement upon the land. And again, I might flag verse 23, that the land and the people will be polluted if something is not done. So here is it's a reminder up to the people, there is a crime that has been committed. Something needs to be done to satisfy that. And so that does two things. One is it reminds the people that indeed there's a problem that needs to be addressed. This is not to be ignored. No sin is to be ignored. No crime is to be ignored. Secondly, it keeps reminding people of blood being shed for atonement. By the time we get to the New Testament, that becomes a matter that's been told over and over and over again. All right. That's verses 1 to 9. Now let's talk about female prisoners taken to war. So let's see what happens to them in verses 10 to 14. Now remember in chapter 20, there were rules for warfare. And I think this has to do with two aspects. One is when they go in to take the nation, but more importantly, if they expand, remember that in our study last time, when they expand to a territory, they were to kill, in some cases, man, woman, and child. In other cases, for example, when they expand the territory, wars beyond the conquest, then they could take captives. And I think this is where this principle comes to application. So when you go out to war against your enemies, this is after they're settled in the land is what I take it. And the Lord delivers them into your hand, and you take them captive, and you see this beautiful woman, and you desire her to take her to be your wife, then you bring her home. And what are you going to do now? Verse 12. Shave her head and trim her nails, and she's going to put off the clothes of her captivity. Well, let's stop there, and then we'll come to verse 13. What's going on here? Well, he sees her and she's very attractive. She's beautiful. Remember that the guys going to war started at age 20, so here they are in maritime age, and they're going out to war, and so they're going to be fighting. Once they're settled in the land, they're going to be enemies. And they come to a territory, and they see a beautiful woman, and he's not married, and he thinks, that's the woman I would like to have for my wife. And so he takes her as a captive. He can do that, and he brings her back with him. He's to do three things. He's to shave her head, trim her nails, and then she is to change her captive garments. Let's start with the third, and then we'll work back up. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, who are pretty reliable, though they're not always right, suggest that it was customary for the enemies or anyone going to war, the women, to make themselves very attractive so they wouldn't be killed in war, but rather be taken captive. So if you see war coming, you saw the enemy coming, their enemy coming to them, they would dress very attractively and an attractive attire so that the soldiers may take them captive rather than kill them. So now that makes sense. He's taking away her hair, she's trimming her nails, and taking away her beautiful clothes. And she's going to change her garment. Now, why does she do that? Well, there's three possibilities that scholars have suggested. One is, some have suggested that the procedure of shaving her head, trimming her nails, had to do with separation from heathen practices. And so she's separating herself. She's part of a heathen culture. She's separating herself from that to become a part of the Jewish culture. Maybe so. Others have suggested that this was a sign of her purification. She was being purified, kind of coupling that with the last. And so she's doing that as a sign of her being purified. She's coming from this heathen culture. She's being purified by shaving her head, trimming her nails, and changing her garment. A third possibility is that he's making her less attractive to other men. She's changing that garment that was a beautiful garment, if Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown be correct. And he's shaving her head, trimming her nails. So what is it? Well, it could be a combination of all. It could be a change of culture. It could be a purification. It could be coming out of heathenistic kind of concepts. And denouncing of that, and it could be that he's making her unattractive to other men, and perhaps even to himself for a time. Her hair will grow back, her nails will grow back, she can put on a different garment later. And so why do I say the latter? Because of verse 13. She is not going to be taken as a wife immediately, is she? What's going to happen? She's going to have a month to mourn for her father and for her mother. And this not as specifically stated here, some have suggested that gives his passions, for lack of better description, a little chance to cool. And maybe the shaving her head, trimming her nails, and changing her garment, she stays close by, but she shaved her head, trimmed her nails, changed her garment, gives her a chance to mourn, and gives him a chance to cool off a little bit, and then he decides if he wants to marry her. Does that make sense? Well, it does. It would do that. Yeah, you're right. It would do that. She's going to be submissive to him in that regard. Now, verse 14 causes me more question than the previous verses, and that is, it shall be that if he has no delight in her, and I'm just going to stop there for a moment. When is that, does this verse come to play? Some suggest that it's after he has taken her as wife. And then he decides he doesn't like her. And I have a problem with that. It could be contingency law, and it is some sort of contingency law, and God's not approving of that. And so several commentators said this is a case of divorce. He's taken her as wife, and he said, you know what, this ain't what I was wanting. But he's had 30 days to think about that. And she's mourned for 30 days, and he takes her. I wonder if it's not fit where at the end of 30 days he's decided this is not what I want. And so the passions have cooled, and she's mourned for 30 days, and maybe she's shown her true colors of her attitude. I'm not sure. But whatever the case, at verse 14, he finds no delight in her. He can set her free, but you certainly shall not sell her. and you should not treat her brutally because you have humbled her. Now, the humble her is the key expression. Some think that has reference to having a sexual relationship with her, meaning he's married her. Others think that he's humbled her only in the sense that he shaved her, he took her garments away, and it doesn't mean he took all of her clothes away, but made her change her garment, her beautiful garment, and trimmed her nails. He humiliated her, and so, no, you're not going to sell her. You can let her go free, send her away. I take it that he hasn't married her, but do with it what you wish. I'm not sure I can argue with you on that. Okay. All right. Very good. Now let's talk about the rights of the firstborn in a polygamous marriage. This illustrates exactly the point we were making concerning contingency law. Let me just stop and talk about polygamy. Were there polygamous people in the Old Testament? Absolutely, there were many. Solomon, for example. How do you harmonize the fact that God never gave his endorsement to polygamy? In fact, when Jesus comes on the scene in Matthew 19, teaching on marriage, he points back to God's law at the beginning, which was one man for one woman for life, which was not in harmony with polygamy. And yet, there were men of God who were polygamous. And the only explanation I can give for that is Acts chapter 17. At the times of this ignorance, God winked at. In other words, there were times, because of a man's ignorance, God tolerated sin. Didn't approve of it, but God tolerated. But now commands all men everywhere to repent. And I don't know of a better explanation than that. And if you've got one, I'd be glad to hear it. But that's all I know to say about it. Did God tolerate it? Well, yeah, he did. Because he was dealing with people who had multiple wives. Did he ever approve of that? There's not any evidence that God ever. In fact, I think I can prove that God disapproved of it. Make sense? So there are going to be cases where there's polygamy. So here's the law. The situation at verse 15 is a man has two wives and he loves one and here is one that's unloved. I don't think that means he doesn't love her at all. It's the same sense of Matthew 10 and Luke 14. Means he loves one more than he does the other. He loves one less. And it's used that way in the book of Genesis as well. God saw that Leah was hated. Remember that? But Jacob loved Rachel more than Leah, the text says. Just loved one more than the other. Didn't hate her. Well, hated her in the sense he loved her less. That's all that means. So that's what this is talking about, I'm sure. So a man has two wives, loves one more than the other, and they each have a son. And now what? He wants to give. No, yeah, exactly. So just because you love this woman more than you love that woman doesn't mean you're going to give the portion to them. It goes duly to the firstborn. Now, verse 17, you might want to flag this for what it's worth. This is the only reference in the law, not in the Bible, the only reference in the law, in the Pentateuch, in the first five books, that mentions the double portion. How did the double portion work? If a man had four children, that means he divided his inheritance five ways, one more than the number of children. If he had five children, he divides it by six. And one of the children, the firstborn son, gets a double portion. So if you had four children, to illustrate, then he divides his inheritance into five portions, and the eldest son gets a double portion, twice of what everybody else gets. This is the only passage, to my knowledge, in the law that mentions the double portion. It's mentioned elsewhere, but not in the law. Make sense? Now, that's a bit of trivia. I don't know what that's going to get you. Didn't get you a lot of edification, but you might win a prize in a Bible contest somewhere. All right. Now, let's move on to the rebellious son. Let's talk about this rebellious son. The situation described in verse 18 is what? The parents have chastened him. Say again. He still doesn't obey. They've chastened him. He will not heed. And so who brings him to the elders? His both parents, his father and his mother, bring him to the elders, and they say to the elders, yeah, he's stubborn, he's rebellious, he won't obey, he's a drunkard, a glutton and a drunkard. And so he is totally rebellious. Now, there's no further evidence demanded here. It's not like now we got to bring more witnesses together for a couple of reasons. Number one, I think would be the fact that if both parents have come forward, the assumption is made that no two parents would do that to their children unless it was true. Number one. And number two, if you need two witnesses, those are two, the father and the mother. And so it is established by those two witnesses. Here's a very practical thing I learned. Before we do that, let's get what's going to happen at verse 21. What happens at verse 21? Once the elders are convinced, they see that it's true, stone him. The men of the city, not the parents, but the men of the city stone him. What'd you say, Jared? Yeah, get rid of the evil in their midst and get rid of that. So rebellion is considered as evil and need to be driven out. Here's a very practical thing I learned from that. I learned a lesson about God over family. You see that? Well, what do you think would happen today if this law was still applicable? We would be afraid to tell the elders of the city because we'd afraid, we know what the elders are going to do. They're going to stone him, and we don't want them stoned. We're going to protect him. People will hear and fear. But the problem with today would be if we took how members of the church handle their children and put that with Old Testament law, they would not go to the elders of the city and wouldn't tell the elders of the city because we know what the elders of the city are going to do. And we don't like that and we don't want that. And they choose family over God, and here was God over family. I want to go back to what Jared just mentioned at verse 21, that when that happens, people hear in fear. Reckon what people are going to think when they hear, you know, Mr. So-and-so and Mrs. So-and-so took their rebellious son to the elders and they stoned him. Reckon what's going to happen to this rebellious child here that's been given one warning, heard of that. Might straighten up, might. What about that parent that's not being diligent in reprimanding the child? You think they might get a little stiffer on that? Maybe so. Absolutely. 22 and 23, let's finish the chapter and then get through chapter 22. We have a body of one hanged on a tree. So what might this involve? This probably wasn't a crucifixion. Some commentators kind of want to wander into crucifixion. That was came about later in time. That means of execution. Execution has been around since Genesis 9. But be that as it may, crucifixion as the form of execution is probably not what it's talking about. It's probably talking about a body that had been stoned might be hung up. I don't mean by a noose, but hung up on a tree. In other words, displayed so that all could see. And that's a case where people are going to hear and indeed fear. So if a man is committed to sin worthy of death and he's put to death and you hang him on a tree, I don't take it that you hung him on the tree to execute him. That was typically done by stoning. But you're displaying his body so all can see. Here's the body of a dead man. Everybody knows what he did. He either committed murder, committed rape, he did something, and now he's been executed, and there hangs his body, impaled to a tree or hanging from a limb, and everybody should hear that and see that and fear, and they're going to tremble. But here's the regulation. What's the regulation? Verse 23. Yeah, it doesn't stay overnight. You get that body off, and you bury that body. Now, at the end of verse 23, cursed is the one that's hung on the tree, is quoted in Galatians 3:13 and applied to Christ. Yes. So where'd that come from in Galatians 3? Quoted right here, this text right here, which wasn't talking about crucifixion, wasn't talking about really wasn't so much a prophecy of Christ. It was just taking this principle, the one that hangs on a tree is accursed. And Paul picks that up and uses that and makes application thereof. Now, you might want to flag verse 1, verse 10, verse 23. There's subtle reminders in this sermon, though major points are not made about it in this sermon, in this second sermon at least, but there's subtle points in Moses' description, and here's what I mean by that. At verse 1, in other words, the subtle point is that God gives the land and God delivers you. You're going into land. You're not conquering it yourself. It's not by your might, not by your power, not by your strength. But you're going into the land, and God did it. God's bringing you there. God gives it to you. So look at verse 1. If anyone is found slain lying in the field, a land which the Lord your God is giving you. The law had to do with murder, but it's, by the way, he points out this is the land God's giving you. Look at verse 10. Same thing. When you go to war against your enemies, and the Lord delivers them into your hand. The Lord delivers them. Look at verse 23. Verse 23. Do not defile the land which the Lord God is giving you as an inheritance. He keeps, just as a little subtle point, let me throw that in. This is God doing this for you. God's giving it to you. God's going to deliver you. God's going to deliver the enemies into your hand. Make sense? Let's go to chapter 22. For lack of better description, I call chapter 22 miscellaneous laws because it deals with miscellaneous laws. What a novel title. All right. Several things, we call them miscellaneous law because they're unrelated other than, as we Callan Daly suggests, they all relate somehow to respect, first of all, for God and respect for neighbor and respect for property and life. So it's respect for others in life primarily, as Daly and Callan Daly point out. All right, let's talk about this responsibility toward others. Let's get the practical thing first and watch for this. One of the things I'm learning in verses 1 to 4 is we cannot ignore circumstances and think that removes my responsibility. I want you to watch for that. I can't ignore circumstances and think that removes my responsibility. So if I thought I had a responsibility toward so-and-so to accomplish and I just ignore like I didn't see it, that doesn't remove my responsibility. And we're going to see that right here. So, let's talk about responsibility toward your neighbor in verses 1 to 4. If you see your brother's ox or sheep going astray, and here's the phrase that I wanted to key on, and hide yourself from them. What does that mean? Look at your footnote. Ignore them. And so you ignore them. You see, that's my neighbor's sheep and his ox. They're wandering off down the road. And so you just ignore that. God's going to hold you accountable for that. You shall bring them back to your brother. In other words, you know it was his ox, you know it was his donkey, or his sheep going astray, you bring them back. Verse 2, here's another scenario. Suppose you don't know who they belong to, or suppose the one that they do belong to is too far away. Yeah, you bring it home with you and you keep it, but when he comes asking for it, you don't say, well, no, these are mine. You say, here they are. You restore it back to him, but you keep them, take care of them. You do the same thing with his donkey. Well, what if you find a lost garment? Same thing at verse 4. Or if he's lost anything, you do likewise, and you must not, here again, hide yourself. Footnote would say, do not avoid responsibility. Don't hide yourself. Well, I'm learning a practical thing there. Don't hide yourself from responsibility. You ever do that? Where you really have an obligation, but you hide yourself. I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to let my presence be known because I really don't want to fulfill that responsibility. You ever been guilty of that? Yeah, I have. And where you sometimes think, well, I'm going to hide myself because I really don't want to do that. And so maybe a practical thing to be learned. Now, at verse 4, if you see your brother's donkey ox fall along the way, what do? Help him lift it up. All right, again, here are things, all of these circumstances in verses 1 to 4 are things that are none of your making. Are you like me sometimes when somebody has created a circumstance that's not of my making, it was of their making and of their mistakes, I think, don't look at me for help. You got yourself in this. And don't ignore that. is the point of verses 1 to 4. Now, this is not New Testament law, recognized, but there's a principle there of not ignoring responsibilities. Now, verse 5 has caused all kinds of discussion over the years, and for obvious reason. So let's tackle verse 5. A woman shall not wear anything pertains to a man, nor shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all who do so are an abomination to the Lord your God. I was waiting for somebody to explain that. Well, I think what we have in verse 5, what we have in verse 9 through 11, and verse, well, let me just leave 9 through 11. Verse 5, verse 9 through 11, have to do with God established distinctions wherein He wants to maintain distinctions. Now, let's start with the misapplication of this principle. This passage has been cited time and time and time again that women should not wear pants. Back years ago when women started wearing pants, particularly women started wearing pantsuits. Some of you are not old enough to remember, but when they started wearing pantsuits, people started quoting Deuteronomy 22:5, women are not to wear that which pertains to a man, etc. Well, number one, this is Old Testament law. So if this is binding on us, then so are the tassels on your garments, verse 12. Are you doing that? I don't think so. I hadn't seen anybody wearing those kind of tassels. For example, the other diverse things, verses 9 through 11, you're not practicing that either. These are Old Testament laws, number one. So this has no bearing on requirements or lack of requirements for women or men today. Is there any biblical principle in the New Testament that pertains to that? Well, the distinction principle is there. 1 Corinthians 11 maintains that. There was a distinction between a man and a woman in headship. Also verses 1 through 16 about their hair and whether the hair was to be long or to be short. There's that kind of distinction. So God has always maintained distinction between men and women. So what's the point here? And I'll save application of that for another time. This tells me nothing about women today. This tells me nothing about men today, with the exception that God has always maintained distinction between men and women. And even I think the principle of 1 Corinthians 11 would apply, that if men come wearing the dresses I see women wear and women were dressed like men I see, I think we'd all have a problem with that. Men ought to look like men and women ought to look like women. And I think there's a biblical principle, but I certainly wouldn't cite Deuteronomy 22 any more than you ought to wear a tassel and cite Deuteronomy 22. Make sense? Or if there's a fornicator in our midst, would I suggest we take him out and stone him? Deuteronomy 22 says do that. It doesn't apply to us today, obviously. All right, let's move on. So it's distinction is the idea, and we'll see more of that in 9 to 11. In verses 6 and 7, this had to do with humanitarian treatment of birds and disrespect for life, that if you found a bird's nest and she had eggs there and or she had young, what can you do and what are you not to do? You could take the eggs or you could take the young, but don't take the mother with it. And it had to do, at the end of verse 7, that it may be well with you and you may prolong your days. I don't think there's a direct correlation between you salvage the bird and you're going to live a long life, but you're going to stay in the land because you're obeying God. That's the point. You're just following God's rules. And so this had to do with humanitarian treatment of birds to preserve. So you save the mother so she can have more eggs and she can have more young and we have more in the future. So you take all the birds and all the eggs and then they're not going to have what they need. Now at verse 8, don't endanger others through carelessness. If you build a house and it has a flat roof, you are to put a parapet. Any of you have a parapet at your house? Got a rail around your front porch? Same thing. It's a rail. It's a small or short wall. It's just the idea of having this flat roof on the top of a house, and that's where guests would go in ancient times, that you put this rail around to keep people from falling off. Do what? It's for protection. And it protects them, but it also protects you because you might be held responsible for it. Now, I want to get to 9 through 11 here quickly, and then I want to get to the tassels on the garment. And so let's see if we can work through this. In verses 9 through 11, Leviticus 19 comes to play. You might flag Leviticus 19, 19. And at Leviticus 19, you probably have a reference to Deuteronomy 22. So let's make that connection. I'm not going to turn there. But you don't sow fields with different kinds of seed. And you don't plow with an ox and a donkey together. Here are things that are not to be mixed. So what's going on in Deuteronomy 22? This seems to be an expansion and an explanation of Leviticus 19. By the expansion, it's simply expanding and giving illustration. Here's one of the illustrations that's not given over in Leviticus 19, taking the ox and the donkey together. You don't plow them together because they're not of the same strength, they're not of the same size, and they don't move with the same speed. And so consequently, that would be hard on one and not the other. So what's the point of verses 9 through 11? It's respecting distinctions that God had established, number one. And number two, it's a reminder of distinctions and separations that they were to maintain. And if they are reminded that we keep these distinctions between men and women, between this seed and that seed, and an ox and a donkey, and we don't mix things that God hasn't mixed, then Deuteronomy 7 comes to play. We're not to mix and mingle with the people of the land. They are to be a separate people. I think that's the emphasis. And so it was a reminder of that principle. Now let's talk about the tassels on the garment. The tassels, you should make tassels. Numbers 15, flag that in the margin of your text if you don't have it, because Numbers 15 explains what this is about. So this passage doesn't tell you. But he's already told them in Numbers 15, verses 37 to 41. It was a reminder of the commandments of God. So the tassels on the garments. Do you remember Jesus talked about you enlarge the border of your garments? Well, that was thought to be more prestigious because I'm giving more emphasis to the commandments of God than you are. You only have a small border, but I've got a big border on my garment. Well, that was a misunderstanding of the law. But the point of it was to look down at the tassel, and that reminds you of the law. You say, where'd you get that? I got that out of Numbers 15, 37 to 31. And it mentions on the four corners of the garment. So some commentators kind of been puzzled by that, what the four corners of the garment are. If you can see my little piece of paper here, I believe it was Jameson from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown mentioned this concept, that it would be an outer garment. And in other words, you take a cloth and put a hole in it for the head, and then when you fold it over and put it over you, you've got the four corners of your garment. And so the four corners are not mentioned in Leviticus, or Numbers rather, 15, they're mentioned here. Just put it on the corners of your garments. So corners, where we're thinking of garments like we would have, like a coat or a dress or a flowing robe, but probably an outer garment. And that is a reminder of the law. Now let's get into the sexual laws here and about where we're not going to get through those. There was this I want to focus on this charge just for a moment, and then we're going to end with that. The charge that a man makes when he got married and he says she's not a virgin, and if it's a false charge, it's going to cost him dearly. But then he stays married to her. Now that's going to go real well, don't you know, after he's made that false charge. But there's to be a test. And the test was that indeed the parents could bring out the proof. We're not told what that was. We can speculate, commentators speculate, but there would be proof, some kind of cloth, and it would be brought out, and here is the proof she was a virgin, etc. But the details of the test are not given there. We're going to have to stop right there. We may back up and review a little of that in our study next time.